From Washington, this is Daybreak Asia. Good morning, I'm Jim Stevenson. Coming up, aid groups and Afghan government rush to help landslide survivors. A strong earthquake rattles Thailand and Burma. Thailand's monarch marks coronation anniversary in a divided nation. These stories and more in this Tuesday edition of VOA's Daybreak Asia. Aid workers in northern Afghanistan are distributing food and tents to the survivors of a massive landslide that buried the village of Abarak. Government officials say anywhere between 250 and more than 2,000 people were killed in the disaster. Sharon Bain reports from Islamabad.
The village of Abarak, obliterated by a giant landslide Friday, has become a mass grave. With the hope of finding anyone living under the tons of mud and debris gone, Afghan government and international aid groups are now focusing on the living. EU Ambassador Franz Michael Melbourne spoke to VOA after visiting the scene.
Like when you're walking on the beach and your footsteps simply disappear behind you, there's nothing to be seen. I mean, there's not even stone on stone. There's just one big, flat, sloping field of mud, which is lying there.
About 300 houses were buried under Friday's giant landslide that followed heavy rains in the northern Badakhshan province. Officials say it is one of the country's deadliest natural disasters. World Food Programme spokesman Wahidullah Amani says there is no hope of finding survivors.
The rescue operation is stopped since there was loss of mass like up to 100 meters, and it was impossible with this local equipment. And what we heard, that there is no hope for anybody to be alive.
Amani said despite challenging local conditions, aid has been rushed to the area.
The good thing is that everybody arrived to the scene, to the area, and they are ready to help. I think more than enough food items and non-food items arrived to the area, and it is being distributed.
EU Ambassador Melbourne said due to the nature of the disaster, which wiped out families without a trace, long-term support will be essential.
They will need, especially the vulnerable victims, the orphans, of which there are many, and widows, of which there are also many, will need some kind of social, psychological support and also some kind of longer-term economic support to reestablish their lives and get along in a society where traditionally it can be very difficult to be a widow and an orphan.
UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon and other international officials have expressed their sympathy to those who lost their homes and families. Sharon Bain, VOA News, Islamabad.
Women and their connection to corporate fraud. That's coming up on Daybreak Asia. A strong and shallow earthquake rattled northern Thailand Monday afternoon. It shook tall buildings in Bangkok hundreds of kilometers to the south, but there were no immediate reports of casualties. As darkness fell, officials warned residents in the province to brace for aftershocks. Daybreak Asia's Sarah Williams spoke with VOA's Southeast Asia correspondent Steve Herman, who felt the shaking in Bangkok.
Well, there was definitely a fairly strong earthquake that shook both Thailand and Burma. We felt it here in Bangkok. I'm on the 18th floor of a 30-story building, and I immediately thought, it must be an earthquake, but this is Thailand, not Japan. It's the first earthquake I've experienced in Thailand. And I actually started to feel a little bit queasy, and then went to the window to see if other buildings were shaking, and it continued shaking for about a minute. Now, here in Bangkok, we have no reports of damage. None of my books fell off the shelves or anything like that. But up in Chiang Rai, in the northern part of Thailand, very close to the epicenter of this shallow quake, when we're seeing estimates between magnitude 5.8 and 6.3, the USGS has it at magnitude 6. But we are getting some photos coming over on Twitter of some damage to homes, things falling off of shelves, baskets tumbling from gift shops, and even some cracks in the road, although sometimes when we see these photos, it takes a while to authenticate them. We also have a report from one of our freelance correspondents in Rangoon, the capital of Burma, that the electricity went out there, and it was felt there as well. So, you know, a fairly good shake, unusual to feel something this strong in Thailand. We have no reports yet of any injuries or any serious damage.
Yeah, I was just wondering, are Thailand and Burma usually considered at risk to get earthquakes?
Well, there is seismic activity in this part of the world as well, but compared to, say, Japan or even China, those areas that are on the intersection of the major tectonic plates, we don't experience the frequent and violent shaking that they get in those areas. But I would say they're a bit unusual, if not rare, to have an earthquake that can cause significant damage. And I'm now looking at more pictures on Twitter coming in from Chiang Rai, which is a beautiful community up in far northern Thailand, also very popular with tourists, hotels with cracks on the buildings, and we expect we can see some more reports coming in like that in the next minutes and hours.
VOA's Steve Herman in Bangkok, and if you haven't already, follow Steve's widely popular Twitter feed. His account is at W7VOA, and you'll receive updates and the latest from Bangkok and the surrounding region. Also, there's more online at voanews.com. It's available on your computer and via your smartphone if you happen to have one. Southeast Asia is seismically active, and quakes are often felt in surrounding nations. Major earthquakes are rare in Thailand, although tremors do often strike in the north of the country. Well, also Monday, Thailand's revered monarch made a rare public appearance to attend ceremonies marking the 64th anniversary of his coronation. Ron Corbin reports from Bangkok that the celebrations came as the government rejects proposals by the main opposition leader to end the country's current political deadlock.
Thailand's revered king, 86-year-old Bhumibol Adulyadej, was greeted Monday by thousands of well-wishers on Coronation Day, a holiday celebrating the world's longest reigning monarch. The ceremony at the royal family's Glai Kangwon Palace in Hua Hin, south of Bangkok, included many leading Thai politicians and bureaucrats, led by Prime Minister Yingluck Shinawat, as well as her political opponents, including former Prime Minister Chuen Leakpai from the Democrat Party. In recent decades, King Bhumibol's public remarks during times of political division have been closely watched. But the king has been in frail health in recent years and did not speak publicly Monday. Nonetheless, the ceremonies, which bring together many of Thailand's political classes, marked a rare moment of unity in a country deeply divided about its political future. In a bid to break the deadlock, opposition leader Apisit Wachachawa outlined plans Saturday, calling for Ms. Yingluck to step aside, allow a Senate-appointed interim prime minister and a reform council ahead of elections later this year. But the proposals were rejected by both the government, which is seeking elections in July, and anti-government groups that have pressed for political reforms before elections. Economist Somphop Manorangsang said that although Apisit's proposals have been rejected, the plan may be revived if political violence escalates in the coming weeks.
The group of people that reject that Apisit idea is made from the government side. Maybe when the situation becomes more critical than now, and there are some hidden power going to make the situation more rebalanced, they may reconsider this kind of proposal.
Thailand has been engulfed in political division between Ms. Yingluck's governing Pua Thai party and the anti-government groups, initially angered by her legislative proposals, including a general amnesty for her older brother, Thaksin Shinawat, who lives overseas to avoid a jail term for corruption. Anti-government groups accuse the government of misuse of power and corruption, while the government says plans for reform are unconstitutional. Somphop says both sides appear too uncompromising in their positions.
Really, unpredictable because the situation has been developed and escalating for quite some months already. So it seems to me that it's more difficult to have the peaceful mechanism to resettle the situation. We can see that both of them, I think that we can see the, from the reaction of the latter uncompromising.
The fate of Ms. Yingluck's government now rests on expected verdicts this month by Thailand's Constitutional Court and National Anti-Corruption Commission after investigations into abuse of power and corruption. Some pro-government groups are calling on the governing Pua Thai Party to reject the verdicts. Analysts fear a further escalation of violence ahead of the final decisions, as both pro- and anti-government groups are calling for supporters to stage rallies amid threats of possible clashes if the court calls for Ms. Yingluck's dismissal or the dismissal of her entire cabinet. In the past 7 months of political violence, more than 20 people have died and hundreds have been injured. Ron Corbin for VOA News, Bangkok, Thailand.
Be sure to stop by our program page for more on this and other stories, lots of photos, videos too. You can find it all at voanews.com/daybreakasia. United Nations officials and other groups are voicing concern about months of heavy-handed security measures against journalists and photographers in Cambodia's capital. Robert Carmichael reports from Phnom Penh, where since January, the government has enforced a ban on public assemblies.
For months now, security guards hired by the municipality of Phnom Penh have attacked journalists and photographers covering protests and rallies and damaged or stolen their equipment. The guards are enforcing the government's January 4 ban on public gatherings, a measure aimed at preventing the political opposition and labour groups from protesting the ruling party. But under Cambodian law, the crackdown against journalists covering the rallies is illegal. On Friday, security guards backed by police used sticks and batons against members of the news media covering a gathering by opposition activists that was banned by the government. A Cambodian reporter was injured in the attack. The head of the UN Rights Office in Cambodia, Wan Hie Lee, condemned the violence on Saturday. She said the government has an obligation to investigate the attacks its personnel have made on the media in recent months and prosecute those responsible. She said any attack on the media has broad consequences for democracy in Cambodia.
It affects the ability of the entire society to obtain the information it needs in order to keep alive the notion of democracy and participation, the inclusive society that Cambodia aspires to become. Impunity does not take place in a vacuum. Impunity in cases of attacks against journalists occurs in a situation where impunity is possible, period.
On Sunday, the Ministry of Information released a statement in which it effectively admitted that matters had gone too far. The ministry's statement condemned, quote, all forms of threatening, intimidation, seizing of material, and insulting of journalists, end quote, and said it considers these actions as, quote, serious violations of Cambodia's press freedom, end quote. The ministry called on state security agents to respect the right of journalists to carry out their job. However, it made no mention of prosecuting those who have inflicted violence in the past. Sebastian Strangio, vice president of the Overseas Press Club of Cambodia, which represents foreign journalists and photographers, as well as some Cambodians, welcomed the government's statement, but questioned its effectiveness at stemming future acts of violence.
Well, we welcome the statement. We welcome the condemnations of these attacks on journalists. The question now is whether this order is going to filter down to the district-level authorities who are thought to be behind a lot of these attacks. That remains to be seen.
The actions come at a time of heightened political tension in Cambodia. The country's political opposition has refused to take its seats in parliament in protest of a general election last July that it claims was marred by fraud, but that official results indicated the ruling party won by a narrow margin. Although the two parties came close to a deal last month that would have resolved their differences, that now appears to have collapsed. Campaigning has begun for a May 18 ballot in which local councillors will vote to appoint the members of two tiers of higher-level councils. Robert Carmichael for VOA News, Phnom Penh.
China's prime minister is emphasizing his nation's commitment to investing in Africa during a visit to the continent. Prime Minister Li Keqiang spoke Monday on China-Africa relations at the Africa Union headquarters building, which was financed by China as a gift to the continent. China's policy towards Africa will focus in the next year on industrial cooperation, financial cooperation, poverty reduction, environmental protection, cooperation on cultural exchanges, and supporting peace and stability on the African continent. Prime Minister Li said that he wants to expand trade between Africa and China. Women and young voters are turning up in large numbers to vote across India, pushing up polling percentages and possibly giving this election one of the biggest voter turnouts ever. Anjana Pasricha reports from New Delhi and looks at the factors that are prompting voters to make their voices heard.
When Ranjana Kumari, a well-known women's activist, went to vote in her village in Uttar Pradesh state recently, she noticed a difference.
I saw groups of women walking to the polling booth with all very beautiful saris and, you know, very happy mood because this was not the scene earlier, also because of the violence and the threat of being intimidated was very, very prevalent. But now with the election commissions taking care of the violence, they have a lot of police personnel posted. So women are also going in large numbers to go and vote.
Election commission data testifies to what Kumari witnessed. Propelled by women and young people, so far 110 million more voters have turned up at polling booths compared to the 2009 general election. In the 438 out of 543 parliamentary districts that have gone to the polls in the phased election, the polling percentage has topped 66%, higher than in any previous election. The Election Commission attributes the brisk polling to a huge voter awareness program it has implemented. Director General at the Commission, Akshay Raut, who supervises the campaign, says they focused on removing what he calls the youth disconnect and the gender gap.
We have engaged about, I think, more than 9,000 campus ambassadors in all universities and big colleges so that everyone is enrolled and everyone comes out to vote. We have women-specific campaigns, communication campaigns. We have got into the life situations where we find these are the difficulties. In some areas, there is a cultural tradition that women do not come out to vote. We have worked with the community there, with the men there and women there, and make sure that these cultural barriers are broken.
The results were evident. In several states across the country, more women than men turned out to vote. Ranjana Kumari says this reflects the deep desire among women to improve their lives in a country where many people are still poor.
There is, across the country, rising aspirations of women, not only in terms of education for their children and also better livelihood, but also political aspirations. They are understanding the value and worth of their vote. They are also looking at the future of the family and their children.
However, many observers say the greater political engagement is not just a sign of vibrant democracy, but also the result of an extremely polarized election campaign. The opposition Hindu Nationalist Party's prime ministerial candidate, Narendra Modi, is leading a no-holds-barred campaign to gain power. While he is projecting development as his main plank, there is heated, often angry debate among his supporters and detractors about allegations that he is divisive. The ruling Congress Party, which is fighting to ward off defeat, calls Modi a threat to the country's secular future. Sociologist Dipankar Gupta says the higher voter turnout is a sign that these are charged times.
This polarization has led to very strong feelings on both sides for the status quo or against the status quo, because there's this great degree of sort of passionate involvement on the side of the voters, and they want to see their point of view carried. It's not a laid-back campaign at all. Every party, every nook and cranny, there's a lot of excitement and commotion.
Whatever the motivation for voters, for the Election Commission, the large turnout is a cause for satisfaction. They hope by the time the last votes are cast on May 12th, India will have witnessed a record turnout. Anjana Pasricha for VOA News, New Delhi.
We hope you're having a great morning, but if you happen to tune in late, no worries. If you have access to the internet, you can download this program as a podcast. It's at voanews.com/daybreakasia. On today's Women Rising segment, we learn the push for more women on company boards is getting a boost thanks to results of a new study. That's because research shows that firms that have a higher proportion of female directors on their board commit less fraud. A research study by CEIBS Professor of Finance and Accounting, Professor Oliver Ruiz, and his co-authors, Douglas Cumming of York University Schulich School of Business and Takyang Leung from Open University in Hong Kong, examine the impact of gender difference on corporate fraud in China. Douglas Cumming tells Daybreak Asia's Francis Alonso what conclusions can be made from the study.
We examine gender diversity on boards of directors amongst companies based in China. We discovered that companies that have more gender diverse boards with up to 50% of women on the board are less likely to be involved in securities fraud. We also discovered that the market reaction to fraud from a gender diverse board is less severe, and we show that the impact of women on the board is more pronounced in industries that are traditionally dominated by males.
So why is that?
There are two competing predictions. One is that women are more ethically sensitive than men are, and a second idea is that diversity itself gives rise to lower likelihood of groupthink, if you will, and better governance, and as a result, less fraud. And our data are consistent with the latter view, that diversity mechanism appears to be the one that's driving the reduction in fraud associated with a more diverse board.
How should companies, global companies, view this report? What should they take away?
Our study doesn't look at the average performance levels. We are more concerned with mitigating the bad actors, so to speak. And as a result, the practical implications are that a good thing for, at least in terms of public policy lesson, is that having a more diverse board can help governance better protect investors and improve companies and their listings.
So now what about in boardrooms? Do you think they'll be opening the doors wide and scooching over their buddies so that way they can let more women on the board?
From what we see in the data, I think it's unambiguously a good thing with respect to mitigating fraud. Diversity on boards is something that we think is important, has been understudied, and perhaps hasn't had enough attention in the business world and amongst regulators and policymakers. This type of evidence can be used to support women's presence in the boardroom and encourage companies to have greater gender diversity on the board. So those are good results in promoting those issues, that's for sure.
Douglas Cumming of York University Schulich School of Business speaking with Daybreak Asia's Francis Alonso, who, by the way, you may hear each week at this time with her Women Rising series. We'd also like to remind you that every Friday you can listen to our brand new program called China Focus. Along with me is our own Sarah Williams. We don't report all the stories from China, but all the stories we report are from China. So we hope you tune in for China Focus every Friday right here on VOA. And just like this program, you can download it as a podcast, listen to it, and take it wherever you go. The latest world news is coming your way next. We invite you to stay tuned for that. Steve Norman has International Edition. I'm Jim Stevenson. Thanks for joining us today on Daybreak Asia.
If you doubt the speed at which the world is changing, just take a look at the digital media. In the last 20 years, the introduction of mobile and internet technology has spawned breathtaking advances in the sharing of information and commerce. Today, an estimated one quarter of the Earth's population uses the services of the internet. Two-thirds of us now own a mobile phone. But these advances into the digital age have been met with problems. Problems like state censorship, hackers, and identity theft, to name just a few. The Voice of America wants to know how the digital world has transformed your life. or have they? We'd like you to tell us your story.